Welcome to the Biblical Studies Group. I'm Dr. James Shelton. I teach here in theology, and this is going to be helpful to me to have a broader perspective. Our first speaker is Alan Dickin, who's professor of geology at McMaster. And without further ado, we'll begin.
Lights off.
Okay.
I don't know if it's feasible.
Can we get the lights?
Okay, that's
well,
a little bit dark.
But
it's all or nothing, I suppose. Okay, well, never mind. It's okay, I thought I would just see if...
There we go.
It's out of problem.
Oh, right, okay, perfect. Okay, thank you. Okay, so... The flood, obviously a very well-known subject, but to my mind, an unfortunate dichotomy is developed in the most prominent models for understanding the flood. So on the one hand, the creationist view, flood geology, as popularized by William Morris, all sedimentary strata were laid down by a global flood, and what seems to become a dominant view on the other side, which I've called the liberal view, that the flood is kind of little more than a parable. Paul Seeley, the flood, not global, barely local, mostly theological. John Goldingay, I assume the flood is another more parabolic rather than more historical story. Parabolic meaning pertaining to a parable, in this case, of course. Now, of course, these guys are both supposedly evangelicals, but frankly, they're espousing non-historical views of the flood. And what I want to explore is whether there's a more historical view of the flood, which is consistent with, well, obviously the Bible, but also with archaeological and scientific evidence. Okay, so obviously we like to have our giraffe puppets in Sunday school. But one would hope that the purpose of teaching the flood in Sunday school would be as a faith lesson. And frankly, this is like a grounding, you know, if this should be, we should be able to take our theory into Sunday school and not have to massage it or somehow dumb it down, you know, I mean, it should be the truth. Okay, so anyway, quoting from Hebrews, by faith, Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear, built an ark to save his family. John Goldingay, 30 years earlier than the previously quoted remark, the way in which the biblical testimonies to faith refer us to past historical events for their explanation and justification makes it difficult to believe that they imply no claim for their story's factuality. So frankly, I'm saying, God saved Noah, my belief that God saved Noah is the grounds for believing that God can save me. And if God didn't save Noah, well, that's a weakened faith, at the very least. Okay, so quick look at what Jesus had to say about the flood. This is kind of a bit of a long quote, but we need to make this comparison between these two descriptions here. Just as it was in the days of Noah, so also will it be in the days of the Son of Man. People were eating, drinking, marrying, and being given in marriage up to the day Noah entered the ark. Then the flood came and destroyed them all. It was the same in the days of Lot. People were eating and drinking, buying and selling, planting and building. But the day Lot left Sodom, fire and sulfur rained down from heaven and destroyed them all. Now, this is an interesting comparison because we know that whatever happened to Sodom, it wasn't a worldwide catastrophe, but it was a local catastrophe. Now, we can argue that destroyed them all is an exaggeration, but the clear sense is that, like, it destroyed pretty much them all. So in the same way, we have to regard the flood as a local catastrophe. Anything less than that frankly, is unbiblical. Now, as some of you may have been in Dennis Lamoureux's talk a couple of days ago, when he was expounding the need to understand Genesis as two separate documents, the priestly and the Yahwist. So I'm just quoting here from the priestly and Yahwist accounts of the flood, which unfortunately I left off the references, but you know where they are. In the priestly account, every living thing that moved on the earth perished, birds, livestock, wild animals, all the creatures that swarm over the earth and all mankind. The Yahwist uses different language, but the same thing. Everything on dry land that had the breath of life in its nostrils died. Every living thing on the face of the earth was wiped out. Men and animals and the creatures that move along the ground, the birds of the air were wiped from the earth. And then we can look at the Mesopotamian sources, two principal epic sources for the flood. The third Mesopotamian source, the Sumerian flood story, is very incomplete, so it doesn't really help us much. After the flood, after recounting the flood story to Gilgamesh, the flood hero, as we call him, describes the scene that he saw after the flood. I looked at the weather, silence reigned, for all mankind had returned to clay. The floodplain was as flat as a roof. I mean, I think you can really visualize this. This is Mesopotamia, you know, looking out over the floodplain from the mountainous ground that the ark had supposedly ran aground on. It was completely wiped clean. This is the image. And in the Atrahasis epic, here the gods are discussing how it was that the flood hero escaped. We, the great Anunna, all of us agree together on an oath, no form of life should have escaped. How did any man survive the catastrophe? The inference here is, I mean, the only person that survived was the flood hero, and how did he? Because, you know, someone told him. So basically we've got four accounts here, which are really separate sources, and they all agree that this was a catastrophe. Okay, so against that light, I want to look at why perceived to be the widely held belief that the flood occurred around 2900 BC. Now, there's good reasons why people think that the flood, the Noah's flood, whatever, occurred in 2900 BC. There are archaeological flood deposits in around the cities of Kish and Shurippak around this time. And these flood deposits, although then, well, they don't frankly cause major damage in these cities, but nevertheless, they do find corroboration in the literature. And one of the most important sources is the Sumerian king list. So this is a kind of a summary here of the first part of the Sumerian king list from the most complete example. That's the one in Oxford, the Well-Blundell prism. Clay prism. And yeah, as I say, this is a summary. So we have five dynasties before the flood, then there's the flood, and then we have the dynasties of Kish, Uruk, and then a whole bunch more. And the phraseology, if I can remember it, something like this. This is like Jakobson's translation. The flood swept thereover. After the flood, kingship descended from heaven. The kingship was in Kish. So this is that kind of the key phrase in the king list, but it's in the middle, and we have our antediluvian section here. And the flood stories also agree with the king list that the flood hero came from Shurippak. So the significant thing here is that Shurippak is the last center of kingship before the flood. And, for example, in the Gilgamesh epic, it's specifically the god of wisdom specifically speaks to the flood hero and says, "Man of Shurippak, go build an ark or something." Okay, that's the evidence. One more thing I meant to say. I won't go in the wrong way. Okay, that is the evidence why it's widely believed that flood occurred at 2900 BC, but there are obviously some major problems with that. this is the argument I'm going to present. Well, the first thing is that this account of the kingships before the flood is frankly completely not at odds with the archaeology. Firstly, there really was no kingship before the flood. If we look at the earliest tablets, the earliest lists of professions, the standard list of professions lists professions in order of their importance. The first entry, which is a kind of a king-like person, is not called the king. The other thing is that in this time period here, the actual dominant city of Mesopotamia was Uruk, which doesn't even appear in the king list before the flood. So that was the picture I was just showing you here. These are the city walls of Uruk around 2900 BC, Jericho, Babylon, and Athens. And what you can see is that Uruk was by far the largest city in the world in ancient times, only equaled by cities like Babylon and Nineveh in the first millennium. Possibly with a population, these are the city walls. In fact, the archaeology shows that the inhabitation went well outside the city walls. Could easily have had a population approaching 100,000. But it's completely missing from the king list. And in fact, the evidence is quite strong that the antediluvian section of the king list was a later addition. The oldest tablets from Nippur don't have the antediluvian section. In fact, it's pretty clear that this section was derived from the Sumerian flood story, which names these cities and their kingships. So, in other words, it's a circular argument to say that the king list and the flood stories agree because they were derived one from another. So it doesn't independently corroborate the evidence. In fact, it's quite possible the original king list didn't even mention the flood. Now, from Nippur, which is a holy city and has the largest collection of ancient literary tablets, theological and all sorts of literary accounts, there's a catalogue tablet in which the catalogues in the collection are listed according to their first two words, the same way the Enuma Elish is the popular name for the Babylonian creation story. The flood tablet is called Nam-Lugal, which means when kingship. So the evidence points to the fact that in fact the original version of the king list began when kingship descended from heaven. The kingship was in Kish. And this is actually supported by archaeological evidence. This is the floor plan of a royal palace from Kish, which shows a unique style of architecture that's not previously seen. This is the floor plan after which this building was copied. It's a labyrinth, and it was designed to get the visiting envoy lost, so that when they finally reached the audience chamber, they were disoriented, and it would enhance the power of the king relative to the visiting envoys. Yeah, exactly. And I've actually tried this particular labyrinth myself on a computer program. I invariably got lost, but my son found it very easy. Okay, so this is showing a new style of architecture, which is evidence that kingship really did begin with Kish, and that this kind of idea that kingship went back before the flood is really, it's a later political statement. Okay, so summary of why we shouldn't use the king list to overrule the obvious interpretation of the Bible. So we know the king list was composed hundreds of years after the floods, which we can see occurred at Kish and Shurippak. In other words, the latest 2100, sorry, the earliest 2100, and it was probably the antediluvian section was added in 1900, so hundreds and hundreds of years later, it doesn't know anything about what happened before the flood, it doesn't know anything about the dominance of a rook for 500 years. It was in any case a piece of political propaganda. Now that doesn't mean to say it's not a valuable document, but it's not the gospel. And finally, it's very likely that it conflated more accounts of more than one event. For example, the account of the Tower of Babel in the Bible. The tower was built long before the time of Abraham, but we know with fairly high degree of certainty Babylon didn't exist before the time of Abraham. In fact, the reference to Babylon in the story of Babel is quite an oblique one. It's really a rhetorical argument. In fact, it's a kind of political propaganda, even though it's in the Bible. So it is basically to blame the tower on Babylon, which was the most prominent object when the Jews were in Babylon in 600 BC. So in other words, a much earlier biblical document has been edited by a later editor with to be a political polemic. So this kind of event is very, this kind of editorial procedure is very common. Okay, so having used up most of my time, I think, but anyway, what is the evidence for the timing of the flood?
You're fine.
Okay. now here's the one that I've read it because it's one of the most important pieces of evidence in my opinion. The biblical account describes Middle Eastern peoples, this will be the Table of Nations, as descended from Noah's sons. The only possible way that this is a credible account is if the flood is in the distant past. If you bring the flood to 2900 BC, 2900 BC is the beginning of the early dynastic period. It's a period of, as I've just said, kings, cities with walls, warfare between cities. It's a mature stage of civilization. To put Noah into that context is completely meaningless historically. Noah has to be credible as the ancestor of Middle Eastern peoples. He has to be in the distant past. Second piece of evidence, the biblical account describes the flood as lasting a whole year. That means prolonged submergence, which would definitely have damaged some of these Sumerian temples built of mud bricks. The oldest existing temple structures go back to 5,500 BC. They don't show evidence of prolonged submergence. The most logical explanation is the flood occurred before Eridu was built. Okay, so a quick look at the scientific evidence for when there were wet periods. I know that some of you have seen this evidence before, but anyway. First piece of evidence is from Lake Van. It's an enclosed drainage basin, but it's very near the headwaters of the Tigris and the Euphrates. So it can tell us about the rainfall patterns in the sources of these rivers, which would then flood. And what we can see, this is a summary, because it's an enclosed basin, the lake level goes up and down relative to rainfall because it has no outlet. It's like the Dead Sea in that sense. So what this evidence shows is there's a dry period around 7,000 BC when the water inflow was low, and then that's followed by a very wet period around 6,000 BC. Now the date of that is not quite precise, but this evidence for a wet period here from near Jerusalem, although it's further away, is very precisely dated. Because in the middle of this event, this is marked by a change in oxygen isotope compositions, which I don't have time to give the scientific reasoning. But in the middle of this event, there's a so-called Holocene cooling event, which is very precisely dated because it can be seen in ice cores all over in Greenland and in other places all over the world. So This is a very wet event, which is around 6,000 BC and afterwards. And it's marked by a sediment layer called Sapropel 1, which is a layer in many drill cores, like seafloor sediment cores, which have a lot of organic material. It's evidence of organic material being washed into the sediment site and then not being able to decay away because there was so much of it, because it was so wet. All right, so if we then look at a drill core in Mesopotamia, the location of this Sapropel 1, the most likely correlation is here. It's been dated at 5,500 to 6,000 BC, and it's immediately overlain by a marine transgression. The significance of this is that we have evidence for a very wet period, which is highly likely to have caused severe flooding of the rivers. And then at the same time, we have the sea level rising and coming from the other side. So basically, if you have a flood, Mesopotamia is a floodplain that prior to this period was above sea level. But when the sea first laps onto the Mesopotamian plain, it means any river floods can't drain away because the sea is blocking them from escaping. So this is the reason why we should expect that a flood in this period, 5,500 to 6,000 BC, would be particularly severe. Now, this coincides with a major cultural gap. It's probably the biggest cultural gap in the history of Mesopotamia. So if we look at the open symbols here, these are cities in northern towns, whatever, settlements in northern Mesopotamia, and you can see one bunch, which are basically before 5,500, and another bunch after 5,000. There's a cultural gap, we don't know why. In lower Mesopotamia, which is in the middle here, this is the Sapropel here, dates 5,500 to 6,000, and then these are the very earliest dates of archaeological remains. The oldest is Oeli, which is a small village that never developed into a city, which is why we can see its very earliest stages still preserved at the present, rather than buried under like 20 meters of debris. And then we have some other small, site called As-Sabaya in Kuwait. And then we have the oldest date we have from Uruk. We don't have any very old dates from Eridu, even though it goes back to the same period. Okay, so the question is, why is there nothing older than this in lower Mesopotamia? So you could say, well, it was too dry, you know, it's a desert. But the fact is that the riverbanks have always been habitable, even in the driest conditions, as in fact it says in Genesis. Water came up from the ground and irrigated the land, and this was always the case. So, you know, you can call me naive, but the simple interpretation is that there were settlements in southern Mesopotamia before the flood, and they were wiped out, and that this was recolonized. Now, okay, so the question has arisen, could Noah's Ark have been built in the Neolithic period before there were any metal tools? The answer is not if it looked like this. And in fact, the Ark, as described, is much larger than the largest wooden ships that have ever been built. So this, I think, is the Great Republic, and there's another similar sized ship called the another similar sized ship called the Wyoming. They were both much smaller than the Ark, and they both had to be reinforced with iron bracing because they flexed too severely when they actually floated in any weather, for sure. Yeah, we should really think what the Ark really looked like was a raft. The significant thing here is that the biblical accounts and two separate Mesopotamian accounts, that is the Gilgamesh epic and also a new so-called Ark tablet, which is a version of the Atrahasis epic, they all describe the ark as the size of a 1 acre field in its dimensions. So if you look at southern Mesopotamia at the present day, you see the marsh Arabs living on these artificial islands with their rebuilt houses and their livestock. An ark could have been built like this. Now, these islands are built of mud. Obviously, these are not floating. But there would have been trees available on the banks of the river to build an ark in the form of a raft in the Neolithic period. In fact, there wouldn't have been trees any later because they'd all have been cut down. So, okay, I'm running out of time, so I'll try and finish just by, I think, with this slide here. Now I have one conclusion slide. If you put the flood at 2900 BC, where does Noah fit in the Age of Kings? Noah's in his tent, he's supposedly getting drunk, he discovered alcohol, and yet we have a city of 100,000 people just next door. It doesn't make sense. This is where we should put Noah. Noah, the priest of Eridu, and then later on we would have Nimrod, builder of Uruk. Now, you might say, oh, wait a minute. Adarpa is the priest of Eridu. Adarpa, who is arguably an Adam-like figure, because he lost the chance of eternal life. But again, you should understand that the myth of Adarpa comes from 1400 BC. It's much later. Frankly, we have a much better idea of when these events occurred than the ancients did, because they didn't have any written records in this period here. They frankly had no idea when the flood was. And so it's not surprising that their chronology got all messed up. Okay, so I'm just going to my summary. Skip a couple of slides there. Okay, so I'm arguing that the widely believed flood in 2900 BC is not consistent with a conservative interpretation. The evidence, in fact, supports the flood at 5500 BC. This is consistent with the belief in the Bible that all Middle Eastern peoples were descended from Noah. Now, this is the outcome of this argument, which I don't have time to talk about, but the roots of biblical religion must be sought in the earliest prehistory of Sumerian civilization, which is the civilization that built Eridu and then Uruk. So this is just a starting point, in fact. And okay, so this is my opportunity to mention my book. So I actually have promotional copies of my book. They're in a box at the back. So if I haven't given you one already, please take one from the box. So thank you very much. Sorry, I've...
No, you're fine.
I'm just in time.
Yeah, you're great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any questions?
Any big sedimentary sections at all? Because if it's that massive flood, wouldn't we get 10, 15 feet of flood-type sediment?
Well, the Sapropel may in fact be the flood deposit, but the marine transgression has certainly erased part of it. It's very hard to tell. It's not automatically clear that the flood would have created a huge sediment deposit, because it very much depends on the sediment supply, and therefore it depends where your drill core is situated relative to the sediment supply. So in a very large plain, the contribution of new sediment could be less than we expect. But there's hugely more research that could be done if it wasn't for the fact that Iraq's a war zone. And there are archaeologists collecting drill cores, although they're not Christians, but we may have more evidence.
Okay, well, thank you, Alan.
Thank you.